Hello, welcome to the Transcontinental Daily Podcast, episode 10. I'm Tom Probert, still at Control Point 4, where today I had lunch with two local shepherds who were tending their flock up on the Transalpina Highway. It was absolutely delightful. I sampled some of their sheep's cheese, which was better than you might think. Tonight, we've got Becky back on the pod, and of course, as always, we've got Rob Quirk too. Hi guys, how are you doing?
I've been on an emotional roller coaster today, Tom. Been waiting for this finish for 10 days. Finally. It's finally come.
Yeah, and have you recovered from it, or are you still on a bit of a high?
Definitely still on a bit of a high. But I think I'm calming down a bit now, though, maybe. But when Fiona wins, I'll be right back up again, and then I'll be down again. And I've been all over the place, Tom.
Nice. Rob, are you managing to hold it together any better than Becky?
Yeah, definitely. I'm not quite beside myself yet, but I'm getting there. Maybe by the end of this podcast. So,
have you found a second emotion, Rob?
Beyond what, indifference? Or no, I am. I think yesterday was a really exciting day. That's where everything was. You know, out on the road, and you didn't quite know what would happen until like Christoph made that made it across the river first. Now it's sort of like watching the inevitable unfold. There's going to be some interesting shakeups to talk about.
The inevitable thing that happened was that once Christoph got over the river, then it was just a case of riding to the finish, really. And he did indeed finish first today. After 9 days and 14 hours, he rode into Burgas. So that's the big news from today. And then the interest and intrigue really is then what happened behind it, because we kind of knew that was going to happen once he'd got that ferry. So how did it all unfold behind him, and what's now happened since he's finished?
There was definitely a bit of drama, because Christoph took that ferry from, is it Ternu Mopo?
Yeah, the middle one.
Magarelli? The middle one. Yeah, let's go with that. whereas behind him, Ulrich made a bid for the furthest western ferry crossing at Bichette. And he arrived only to find out what we all knew was that no ferries were running from Bichette because of the low tide, right? So having made it to Bichette in an attempt to get a later ferry, ride through the night and potentially still be on par with Christoph, he then found himself 130 kilometers from the ferry that he eventually took from the furthest east crossing. And within minutes, he was out of the race for the win.
Yep. Poor guy. He was devastated, as you'd imagine.
But he did then take the ferry, the first one this morning, I believe, from the furthest eastern ferry with, there was four of them, with Pavel Polorski, with, I'm trying to find the other name, sorry guys.
Adam got there as well. So Adam was down there already, kind of just waiting at that ferry, like that was his plan all along. And then yesterday, what we were looking at was the guys that were coming off the parkour, they suddenly had a kind of 7 hour window, or like a 7 hour advantage where the other guys normally would have been riding, but actually they were having to wait for the morning ferry. So we were looking at who of those guys could maybe make it down to get that first ferry of the day. And it ended up being Christian Jakobek and Pavel, and they all got the same ferry with Ulrich and Adam. So there were four of them that ended up on the other side of the river, and it
which
was effectively
astonishing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's given at CP4, which was however many kilometers before, Christian was, I'm looking now and it looks like he was about 18 hours behind Ulrich when he got to the fourth control point. And a mere couple of hundred kilometers later at the border crossing, they were effectively neutralized and that lead was wiped out.
The interesting thing is that we were kind of thinking the guys that did make it down to the ferry would have had to put in such a shift to get there and then they wouldn't have had any kind of break. So whereas at least the guys like Adam had a proper good night's sleep there, Ulrich less so because he was having to cycle around between different ferry terminals. But Adam had a nice sleep and then the guys that got down there would have had to just pretty much carry on. So we were thinking they'd be at quite a disadvantage, but apparently not, because Christian just then went out and smashed it to the finish and didn't seem to be a huge disadvantage to him at all.
No, I agree. I was totally surprised to see that happen. You would think that not having had that extra rest when you probably need it most would be a massive disadvantage, but clearly not. Perhaps you carry on some kind of momentum.
Christian himself, he described it as entering berserker mode, which Tom managed to get a little recording before of him at the finish.
Let me actually, I can just play it out live here. Let's
much
farther than I can. And it was like, I call it the berserker mode. And it's really hard to turn it on. And it's like going on a real depth. I don't know. It's this feeling that I stopped feeling pain, actually.
Yeah.
Because I felt that I'm overstressing my knees and all other joints, my muscles. But I was like perfectly fine with it.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, f*** it, let's go for it.
There you go. So he couldn't feel any pain in berserker mode, which is a massive advantage if you're in a bike race.
Mm. Yes. Well, I think a lot of riders get this towards the finish. If you look at where Christian was over the past few days, he's obviously been riding at a pace, but maybe not quite the same pace as Ulrich and Adam. And then you find that when you have that sniff of the finish line, you can taste it almost.
Mm.
And then something inside you just clicks and you have this well of energy and determination that perhaps you never had before, because you're, especially on a race like Transcontinental that's over such a distance and amount of time, when you start, you're not really thinking about the finish. But then when you get this close, and of course it's across a country, but you know, it's several hundred kilometers, but still this is like, that is like as close as you're going to get to a sprint finish as you would in one of these things. So I think a lot of riders get this where they have this intense sprout of energy. I just know as well, because he would have like flown into the finish like in full berserker mode and then just stop and be like, oh, that was it. You know, if he's lucky, Christoph would have been there to shake his hand, but it's this weird sensation.
Yeah, the rest of that recording was quite nice, actually, because it was Christoph and him having a chat and it sounded like they were, you know, just reliving all the tales of the road and congratulating each other and stuff. It was really lovely. I should just say, actually, that we kind of glossed over Christoph Strasser, finishing first, because it was slightly less dramatic than what was going on behind him. But that is still an absolutely incredible ride that he's done. And it's his first unsupported event that he's ever done. You know, obviously he's well versed in supported racing, but he's had to really learn on the fly a lot of different skills. And he, from the start, never had any expectation that he could or should win it. So it was a real learning curve for him. And it's pretty impressive that he can come into something completely new and a completely different discipline that he saw as something where he was a complete rookie coming into it. Massive congratulations to him.
Absolutely. And I saw someone post on the Transcontinental Facebook group that yesterday, so the 2nd of August, was exactly 1 year since Christoph took the 24-hour, I think it was the Guinness World Record.
Wow.
And he's just such an exceptional endurance athlete who's turned his hand quite easily, or seemingly quite easily, to the unsupported side. There were a couple of routing errors early on, and I think it's probably testament to his physical strength that he was able to make up for that time. But he, as much as he did ride well and hard, I would argue that he got a little bit lucky. Ulrich aiming for that furthest western ferry that wasn't running just opened the door.
I don't know. I disagree because regardless of which ferry they were heading for, at the end of control point 4 and the parkour, Christoph did not waste any time, and he rattled it straight down there to catch a ferry on the same day. I think the last ferry was at 5:30. Was it? I don't know which ferry he got on, but you know, the ferries.
I think it's half seven. Yeah.
Half seven. All right.
Yeah,
so
he made sure he got on it.
Yeah. Whereas when you go back and replay that part of the race, you see Adam and Ulrich kind of hang about a bit. I mean, Ulrich was having various problems. I think that was probably his worst day in the race.
Do you think it could have been, I mean, I've heard from a couple of people just how hard that final parkour, that fourth parkour is. And do you think Christoph's recce of it before the race effectively allowed him to finish first?
It would have played a big advantage in the, for sure. Because, I mean, when he was asked before going to the parkour, you know, they said, are you looking forward to it? And he was like, no. So he knew what he was in for was, definitely been in those situations where things are going really bad, or you didn't quite realize how tough a section was going to be, or maybe you looked on the map and you were like, oh, it's only this distance that won't take me long. And then 5 hours later, you're like screaming at a hillside. All these things would have played in. I mean, I thought it was interesting, like things like Ulrich was fashioning knee warmers while he was on the parkour, and I couldn't help but think, like, whether, you know, his time could have been better spent, because, you know, obviously his knees were cold, but then it maybe instead of spending time trying to fashion knee warmers, is you just keep moving and you get off the mountain, get off the parkour and drop down, and like doing that as fast as possible seems to be more sensible. But when you're in these situations, I mean, that's one of the things I've taken away, or I've got better at, is like when I first did TCR, I wasted so much time just doing things like that. And then afterwards you realize, oh, maybe my time would have been better if I just rode my bike and it would have sorted itself out.
Yeah, I think by the time...
Maybe I'm being unfair.
I think by the time Ulrich got to control point 4, he'd suffered sort of so much, or had to suffer through so much adversity and kind of pain with his knee, and I think he was really, really pushed into quite a bit of sleep deprivation, and he was really beyond the limit, I think, at that point. So he was really kind of hanging on, and Christoph was quite the opposite. You know, we saw them going up the Transalpina climb on the way to the control point, and the contrast between the two of those guys, just in the way they looked on the bike, the way they were climbing, the way they were talking, everything was complete polar opposites. And yeah, Ulrich was trying to put a brave face on it, and he just about got himself to the control point, but even when he got there, he was really finished already. So that was before going to do that parkour, you know. And so
wow,
I'm not surprised. Maybe it took a while to do
that
it.
That just adds yeah, adds even more to his story and his determination, because the fact that, yeah, I mean, we've said this throughout, that, you know, whenever he has a problem, we're always surprised that he's still moving.
Yeah.
But yeah, maybe he dug too deep. I mean, that is something that James said the other night, was when he first started racing, he might have pushed too hard. Whereas yeah, now he thinks about, he's like, okay, now isn't the time. But if I, you know, if I pull out now, or if I slow down, or if I do this, it means I get to race more races. Whereas by the sounds of it, Ulrich will have to spend a long time recovering from this.
I think
true.
So.
And this, yeah, is a longer race than Ulrich's ever done, I believe. Whereas I think Christoph's,
yeah,
Ram record is just over 7 days, 7.5 days. So it could just be that this length is, that Ulrich hasn't quite paced himself for this length well enough, especially given how hard the end of the race is.
We just talked about the control point for parkour, and that's been quite a big talking point today, because a couple of high profile riders have gone through there and had some pretty serious complaints about it, you know, to the point where they're saying it's dangerous. So Ulrich was one of them, and then Fiona Kolbinger as well was making her feelings quite clear about that. It'd be interesting to hear your guys' thoughts on what you think about that.
I mean, yeah, I've seen a lot of this coming up on Instagram and other social media, where people are having particular, you know, exception with this parkour, but some people might think that it's something that's a new development, but from day one, there's been, you know, from the first TCR, there's been really savage gravel sections.
Yeah.
Mike Hall purposely put these in. I mean, they would talk of the TCR as in referencing the Tour de France back in the golden age of cycling, you know, when, you know, you've got guys cycling up goat tracks or what have you, and that, you know, the Tour de France would have stages that were done at night and everything like this, you know. It was, you know, a different time, and very different to how it is now, and that's something that I think Mike wanted to recreate, but also it was meant to be a taster of when he did the round the world race. It's meant to be a taster of that as well. And where he undoubtedly would have gone down crazy gravel roads and had a really hard time, but that was the whole point. It isn't just about racing your bike. It's not just about being an exceptionally strong rider, everything in this race has to be considered, from your ability to navigate, to plan a route, to deal with different weather conditions, to go across different countries and different cultures and be able to deal with those barriers. And of course, is to deal with terrain that, that may not be ideal. And I think that's why people love this race so much. It's like, because you can't, I mean, we were laughing at Ultan Coyle. He had, when he did, I think it's TCR number 3, he had this time trial bike set up and he had custom carbon frame bags made. Yeah. So he was super aero, super great. But then he came undone slightly to a point on the really tough gravel climb, which I've forgotten the name. Please, we mentioned it yesterday.
The Assietta, was it?
Yes, I think that's Strada, it, yeah. Assietta, and
the one in Italy.
Yeah, that's the one. And yeah, it's the same thing. There's always been these super hard gravel sections. And it was the same a few years. I think it was the same when you did it, wasn't it, Tom? Because you purposely took a bike with bigger tires because this gravel section would be tough. And that's the problem where, everyone's coming, or not everyone, there's various people coming out saying, oh, this is too dangerous. But it's like, well, actually, maybe, there needs to have been more done in prep was, we spoke about Ulrich's bike a lot yesterday and like the choices he made. And yeah, it's great on the road ride, but maybe for that very short gravel section that you're going to do, you need to make some compromises in your setup just so that you don't come completely undone.
I'm of somewhat a different opinion. I think this 1 45-kilometer parkour.
fight.
This 1 45-kilometer.
How dare you?
This is great stuff.
He's been cancelled.
This is what we want.
It seems a bit short to have a 1 45-kilometer parkour that riders have to consider in their bike choice and potentially widen their tyres. And I remember seeing a pair who had knobbly tyres on the TCR I did, which just seems like such a big consideration considering how short the parkour is, and especially how consequential this parkour has shown itself to be. I think it's probably just a bit too hard. But I do like that the TCR goes off-road, and the TCR I did, we had that gravel parkour in Serbia, hey Tom? And we went up to that observatory. And I think the idea of taking riders where they otherwise couldn't go by going off-road is a really good thing. And you have these moments where you know you'd never come here on your own, and you're only there because the race has brought you there. And you may not feel it at the time, but you're quite thankful. My argument, or my problem with some of the parkour, is when it just feels a bit gratuitous. And the third parkour on RTCR is probably my example of this, where we turned off a main road, went up a back road through some vineyards. It was crazy steep. I think everyone walked it. I shredded the carbon soles on my shoes, and then you just rejoin the road that you left. And that, to me, because I hadn't gone anywhere new and exciting, I just gone parallel to the road that I turned off. That was a bit more frustrating for me. Although James Robinson clearly loved it because he seemed to take a photo of every rider walking on it.
Sorry, it's bringing flashbacks from Pennine Rally for me. Another race.
Was it good?
yeah, obviously people race it. And the funny thing is, because of the way it's marketed as a rally, you see all these pictures of people having a good time and smiling and, having picnics and barbecues and stuff. But the reality is, like, some of the sections that you do on that ride, I mean, it's taken from the great, or big parts of it are taken from the great Divide route. Is that right? Yeah, the Great Divide route. Oh, no, sorry, the two cities. Two city, city divide. Second city. I'm getting there. Yeah. I'm getting there. You start the ride thinking it'd be a lot easier than it actually is. And then, you know, I found myself walking more than every. I mean, when I was doing it, I was like, wow, I'm having flashbacks to Atlas Mountain Race. It was just incredibly hard. And I had the same thing where after a while, I was just like, oh, they're just putting this in, just to make it really, really hard. And I'm kind of sick of this now. And I'm sick of pushing my bike.
Do you know what you
uphill,
need,
but also pushing it downhill.
Go on, you need a better bike.
Yeah. Well, but this is the thing was, you know, that ride was 60% on road and 40% off road. And if I was ever do it again, I would 100% take my 29er because just even though there's so much tarmac, it's just like, yeah, I'd rather be on a mountain bike and be slightly, slightly slower on the tarmac than having these really like these moments where you're just like cursing, you know, the sky and like you feel so dejected because you're pushing your bike forever. And it is exhausting. And yeah, I think at the time it feels really bad, but looking back, I'm like, actually, that was really cool and really rad.
Yeah.
But for me, the big question is having experience or having enough forewarning so that you can prepare for it. The thing for me is like, it's only bad because I wasn't prepared for it in the right way.
And it's a good point about how you say the distance was 60-40 tarmac to off-road. But the time split would be really different. Probably swung the other way to spend 40% of your time on tarmac, 60% of your time off-road. And I said it was a 45-kilometer parkour, but how long were the riders out for? 4 hours on that, maybe?
Christoph Strasser took 5.5 hours, I think.
Yeah, Rob, I was just watching. I was watching your friend of mine, Rob Webb, on the parkour today, and we just missed him. We were trying to get some photos this morning. I can't remember exactly what time it was, but it was in the morning. We just missed him as he got onto the parkour, and I just checked before we started recording this pod, and he was just getting to the end of it. So he's literally spent all day on there.
Yeah,
and, yeah. You know, that's the reality of this.
I'd love to know how Robin Jean-Pierre and Seb Brewer got on because they're former professional mountain bikers. I bet they're
I don't think they're going to complain. They're probably like, well, at last.
Yeah, well, I heard that Robin ripped into it, you know, as if he was in a mountain bike race and just instantly got a puncture. So...
amazing.
So no one's immune to it.
The photographers always seem to know where to place themselves so that you look at them just at the moment that you hit something rough and you puncture, so that they then get a photo of you fixing a puncture. James Robertson must be born with a sixth sense for it because he's notorious.
His pockets are full of nails.
Yeah. The TCR's been rigged.
I always puncture when I see you.
Yes, oldest trick in the book, isn't it? Wily old photographer. So we've been talking about the front runners coming through this parkour, and the interesting thing that we have to remember is that everybody's going to have to come through this parkour, including all the riders in the mid pack and towards the back of the race. And we wanted to just highlight a couple of those riders because there's some interesting little scenarios playing out now where there are people trying to make these cutoffs for control points. And you guys have had a quick look at a couple of them, haven't you?
Mm. Yeah, so I think we mentioned about, or you guys mentioned about the final rider into CP2 and how emotional he was just to make the time cut. He was Frederick Rudant. I'm doing that British thing where I say every foreign name like a question.
That's Australian.
And then, but you pointed out about Eric Venneman.
Yeah.
Who's still riding at the moment. And we had a quick look at how far they have to go and how far they have to go to the checkpoint, which closes at 1 a.m. on the 5th. So
yeah,
they have, from now, about 25 hours?
There's a complication with time difference, which I can't quite work out 100% with 100% confidence. But I worked it out, I thought that he had 27 hours to get there. That was probably about an hour ago. So maybe 26 hours. But I worked out that he had 1 hour more than he needed to get there if he just kept cycling all the way at his current average moving speed. So,
wow.
Man.
So that's tight. So he has about 425 kilometers to get there.
He either needs to go quicker or not stop.
Yeah. Coach Rob.
The next 27 hours. Yeah. You can sign up to my coaching tips at the end of this podcast.
That's the kind of innovative thinking that, you don't just get everywhere.
No, it's the veteran insight you only get on this pod.
Yeah. Well, I'm not wrong.
No. So that's Eric. But then Frederick's got quite a significantly longer way to go, hasn't he, to the control. So it's very difficult to see him scraping in there.
What do you think he needs to do?
A coach? Well, he bloody will, because he's got 530k to go. And I really can't see that happening.
And he's still a Lantern Rouge. No one else behind him.
He was the Lantern Rouge to CP2.
Yes.
But
wow,
it looks like of everyone who's still in the running, Eric Venneman is the one who has the best chance of of getting to CP3 within the time cut. But it's going to be close.
Interesting little drama to keep your eyes on there. And I don't know if you've noticed, he's got a little mascot on his bike, which is like a little miniature version of himself. He's got quite a distinctive big red bushy beard, and he's got his little mini-me.
Yes,
taken with him, yeah, which is pretty cool. Right, who wants to do a scratch report?
Yeah, I'll go for that.
Who wants to butcher some names?
Yes. Well, it's not a very big list today, which it's is not. Good. There's only four people on it. We've got Junning Lai, 145, Thomas Cretchell, 207, Eric Spencer, 119, Benoy, how do you say that? Benoy? Forrick,
Benoit,
91.
I believe.
Benoit, thank you. Sorry, my French.
This is why we have cap numbers, so we could just reduce everyone to a number and do away with names. It's for the Brits who can't pronounce foreign names.
Yeah. Exactly. Yes. And I even think I've got an inkling. I might have mentioned Eric yesterday, so it might only have been three scratches today, which is phenomenal. You can see definitely from the start, you have a few, and then you hit this peak, this crescendo, which is what we said at the beginning. It's normally between CP2 and CP3, you see the biggest amount of scratches, and then it starts to tail off again. And I think that's it. It's like you hit a point, and it would appear the point was around 7 days. In this race, where if you make it past that point, I think everyone knows it's like, okay, we can keep going, we can make it.
Yeah,
it's just as easy to carry on as it is to scratch potentially.
All right, so we've been trawling through some of the social media coming out of the race. So let's just have a quick look at a couple of Instagram posts that we've found. Who wants to kick off with that?
The first one is from the Transatlantic Way, which I assume is written by Adrian O'Sullivan. He's a TCR vet as well. And it's just a congratulations to Christoph for finishing first. And he mentions about how the finish of an ultra, well, I guess we should highlight an unsupported ultra race, is often quite anticlimactic. And how different it might be to Christoph's wins, his 6 wins at Ram. Although I know there's still a couple of people, there are a couple of people at the finish in Burgas, and the control point is fairly well staffed. So there are definitely a few people there, but there won't be the fans that you see in a supported race. And I wonder if he knows that. I wonder if that comes as a surprise.
Have you seen any videos of him finishing today?
No.
It does look very, very low key. It's quite funny. You know, he just sort of rides up to a little hut on the beach and Rory Kemper's there, and it's like there's basically no one there. It's really funny.
But Rory's there. I mean,
what more
it doesn't
do you want?
Matter about anyone else.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, what more do you want at the end of a race? But yeah, it's a very charming and kind of admirable part of this sport, isn't it? That it's so sort of down to earth that, you know, you just kind of finish, and if you're lucky, I think, was it Josh was talking about this yesterday? You know, someone might just give you a beer and sort of leave you to it. And it's...
Yeah.
And then it's time to sort of reflect on what you've done.
Yeah, start that big, long journey of reflection.
I thought you were going to talk about the big, long journey of trying to find a box to put your bike in to fly home with.
If there's ever a perk.
It becomes savage, the fight. If you, I mean, Christoph is first, he won't have a problem.
I was just going to say, like, it's the perk of being the first one there. You get dibs. Yeah.
You get the best box. I think TCR are actually supplying boxes.
I didn't even get a box. I ended up cling filming my bike to get like literally taking the wheels off, putting them on the side, and just running it with cling film, because like you couldn't get a box because every box had been, you know, cleaned out by other riders ahead of me.
Is that an advert for how sturdy your bikes are? We don't even need a box.
Yeah, well, it got lost as well. It disappeared. That was a real, like, heart-rendering thing, where I got back to London and then I was just stood in the airport waiting for my bike to come out, and it never came out. Oof. And then I was like, oh. It's like, wow, I've just spent, like, 2 weeks on this thing. And I hadn't realized how attached I'd grown to it. Mm. It was, and that was like, that was probably the most emotional I got. No.
I was expecting you to say, oh, well, I'll just build a new one then.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, and that's how Quirk Cycle started. No. it's just a cover to build myself bikes.
Did you ever get it back?
Yes, I did. It came, it got, it arrived at my door, I think, nearly 2 months later.
Whoa.
The next social media post that we picked out was from the Transcontinental's official page, and it's a shot of a rider, Stefan, at the fourth control point, and he's wrapped these, is it an emergency bivy or a foil blanket around each of his legs in a very DIY leg warmer style, but I'd imagine very effective, if not a bit noisy.
why does nobody have leg warmers this year?
Everyone at the back of the pack has got them.
I mean, did everyone just go, won't need these? Sorry, come on. Because that really is a theme. Everyone is like fashioning leg warmers and everything, which, I don't know. The mind boggles. Or either that or everyone's losing their leg warmers.
The first two TCLs I did, I took leg warmers, didn't use them. And then the third TCR I did, I thought, oh, well, it's always really hot on TCR, so I won't take my leg warmers. And it was freezing, so I had to buy some on the way.
Serves you right.
Yeah.
But I wonder if everyone at the back of the race has just got the ones that the front runners have dropped. They'll be coming in with like three pairs each.
Yeah. Yeah.
They look cool, though. They look cool, these.
Yeah, they look really cool.
Foil leg warmers.
They look
really cool. Very Daft Punk.
So, Daft Punk, Star Wars, maybe. Yeah. I don't know.
Maybe it's a good time to give a shout out to, is it Stefan Amato, who's running the Transcontinental social media?
Oh, yeah.
Steph, have been enjoying it so much. It's been really refreshing to have that kind of funny, wry sense of humor behind it. And it's in many of the riders' mishaps, and tribulations, there's just a bit of a dry sense of humour that I think a lot of TCR vets and many people in the sport will find quite funny. So if you haven't had a look already, I definitely recommend going and reading his words, and the photographer's photos are pretty good as well.
Yeah, well done, Steph. That man is working hard as well, let me tell you. He's absolutely really put in a shift over the course of this race. So well done.
It's almost easier to ride these things.
Yeah, I can confirm that. Nice. Let's do one listener question, shall we, before we go?
Let's do the water one, okay? Yeah. So Priscilla Cassidy in New York State, USA. She asks, how do riders deal with finding sufficient water? Even if you have a filter, are there reliable options either to buy or filter? Or are TCR people just camels?
It's a good question. And I think a lot of vets of bikepacking races will say you can often end up with an unholy amount of single-use plastic at the end of one resupply, and it all just goes into a general waste bin next to the service station or wherever you've just bought your stuff from. So a lot of people do tend to look for tap water, and it's personal choice on whether you're happy to drink the tap water from everywhere en route or whether you might prefer bottled water. I know I drank tap water the whole way through. I think I had to buy one bottle of water. Otherwise, people are generally pretty receptive. If you walk into a shop, don't speak a word of the language, but just point to an empty water bottle, you're probably going to get it filled up with water.
Yeah, I think also this question a lot of people ask, maybe the first time you do a race like this or when they're doing a race in an unfamiliar country. But I think with the Transcontinental, it's mainly in Europe. But even, when you go into the furthest reaches of the continent, there's always shops, there's always hotels, there's always places to get water and to fill up. So I doubt there are many, if any, riders that have a filter. And yeah, I mean, I think the furthest I ever had to ride was 70K without resupply, without anywhere to get water, which, is completely doable on two bottles of water. I mean, the only time I've ever had to actually filter water on a race is in Kyrgyzstan on the Silk Road Mountain Race, where you're literally in the middle of nowhere and you need to filter from streams or what have you. I mean, even Morocco, I never, there's, you hit shops or resupplies often enough. Of course, for a race like that, you carry more water. But on transcontinental, can't remember, 2 bottles, maybe 3 bottles. I think I only had 2, and it was plenty to get you through.
Yeah, that is the beauty of the TCR. You're never too far away from civilization, are you? There's always a gas station with a 7 days croissant and a bottle of water to keep you going.
Yes,
that's all you need.
Yeah, absolutely. Ice well, cream. Can I just say, what a way to finish the podcast.
No, you can't.
Okay.
Edit that out.
Yeah.
I insist.
Yeah. Come on. It deserves better than that. Anyway, what I'm trying to say is that's all we've got time for. We need to wrap this thing up. So thanks so much, Becky, for coming back on. Welcome back whenever you want.
Thanks very much for having me, guys.
And cheers, Rob, once again, for sticking this out. I think you've been an absolute stalwart here. You've only probably missed one episode, haven't you, I think?
Yeah, one or two, but no problem at all. I really enjoy it. It's good to be here. Nice to see the race unfold and have a good old laugh.
Yeah, man. Yeah, it's good fun. Right, well, I'm glad you're enjoying it because we've still got a few more days to go until the finishers party. So we'll keep it going till the end, like just like the riders. Don't forget, as always, keep sending those questions in to race@transcontinental.cc with pod question as the subject. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe, leave a rating and review, and we'll see you back here tomorrow. This podcast is supported by our race partners, Apidura, Physique, Hutchinson, Kinesis, Komoot, LEM Helmets, and Pedaled. All the music has been created for this series by Joe Skinner.
I did think if I had any brains, this time of year or like 2 weeks ago would be the perfect time to buy some shares in Sudocrem, because you'd have your money back and more within 3 weeks.
I'm not sure that's how it works, but yeah.
You'll regret that when I'm a millionaire.
Covered in Sudocrem.